For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. Acts 17. If you were here last week, we're in the middle of the second journey that Paul took. And we left him in Philippi last week. And he was just leaving Philippi when we tuned out at the end of 16. Then it says that they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia. They came to Thessalonica, where there was a Jewish synagogue. Let's get our map back out. I got a different map this week. So we've traveled all this distance up to Philippi. Then here tonight, he's traveled about 70 miles from Philippi over to Thessalonica. Later, he's going to leave Thessalonica and go to the nearby town of Berea. And when trouble breaks out there, he's going to probably take a ship down to Athens. So that's the part we're going to be covering tonight. As was his custom, Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days, he reasoned with them from the scriptures. We see how every city he goes to, that's his first stop. It's the synagogue. He did this not only because he was a respected rabbi from Jerusalem and so could get an easy hearing in these synagogues, but also because theologically he believed that because of the dues that the Jews had paid for all these years, being the chosen people of God, that that entitled them to the first shot at the gospel. Romans chapter 1, to the Jew first, then also to the Greek. And that's why he would always give them the first opportunity. And we read that, as was his custom, he went there on 3 days and he reasoned with them from the scriptures. Now remember, the New Testament not written yet at this time. There is no New Testament. So the scriptures he's referring to are entirely the Old Testament scriptures. He's reasoning with them from the scriptures, meaning that he's coming in and showing them the prophetic aspects, the prophetic sections in the Old Testament, and how these pointed toward not just one coming of Messiah, but to two comings of Messiah. One as a suffering servant who would be rejected, humiliated, and die, and then be raised from the dead. And then a second coming where he would come as a triumphant king to rule the world. And also showing all of the typology in the Old Testament, how the picture contained in things like animal sacrifice and the festival calendar and all of those things pointed forward to the work of atonement that was ultimately done by the Messiah, Jesus Christ. So he's arguing to them from their own books that they're long familiar with, that this has all been predicted in advance. But at the time, they had not been expecting two comings of the Messiah. They had only expected one coming. So this was a bit of a surprise. And many of the passages about the suffering servant coming of the Messiah were not even understood to be about the Messiah. They didn't know who it was about, but it couldn't be Messiah because the suffering servant is weak, he's obscure, he gets beaten, he gets rejected, he gets killed. Something that could never happen to the Messiah. So they're just like, well, we don't know who he is, but he's obviously not the Messiah. Well, guess what? He is the Messiah. And there's two comings. And so this was a lot to swallow for people. You know, quite a shock when you're used to thinking about things one way. It's paradigmatic thinking. You're in one paradigm, and now you got to stop and think, what? So, yeah, so there's a whole different thing here, and that's basically what he was doing. And so we read that he was explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead, that this was part of the career of the Messiah. This Jesus I'm proclaiming to you is the Christ, he said. Some of the Jews were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks and not a few prominent women. So he was reaching people with this message. I also want you to notice that in the previous passage, it says he reasoned with them from the scripture. So he's reasoning with them. Here he's explaining, giving evidence, and then he is persuading people All of these are the language of thought, persuasion, and reason, which we have today in Christian circles, a whole movement that says things like this are a big waste of time, and that there's no use trying to persuade people of anything. You just live, and you just send out vibes, and people just pick up on it, and that things like apologetics are a complete waste of time. I guess Paul must have missed that part, huh? It looks like he thinks that reasoning with people and giving them evidence is worthwhile. And it does work, as we're seeing. So the New Testament pattern includes persuading people and not just holding for some fideistic, you know, fideism, faith, blind faith, faith for faith's sake type of faith. Now, if you have NIV, it says that he was proving and explaining and proving that. That's a wrong translation, I think. Paratithemi just means to set before. It doesn't mean to prove. And to demonstrate, to give evidence. And that's what we have here. It doesn't prove. You can't prove God. You can't prove Jesus. But you can show a high level of plausibility and likelihood, and the inference to the best conclusion takes you to the fact that this looks like it's true. More likely than in that it's false. And that's what we have. That's what we've been given. Well, the other Jews were jealous, so they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace and formed a mob and started a riot in the city. They rushed to Jason's house in search of Paul and Silas in order to bring them out to the crowd. Jason is a local guy. He's from Thessalonica. But when they did not find him, they dragged Jason and some other brothers before the city official, shouting, "These men who have upset the world have now come here, and Jason has welcomed them into his house. They're all defying Caesar's decrees, saying that there's another king, one called Jesus." Well, that was a convenient charge to lay. Of course, Jesus himself had said, "My kingdom is not of this world." But notice the description they use, "these men who have upset the world." Oh, that we could be described that way today. And it's been a while since we've heard followers of Jesus described that way, I'm afraid. When they heard this, the crowd and the city officials were thrown into turmoil, and they made Jason and the others post bond and let them go. So they had to take a substantial amount of money and post it as a surety, as a bond, which then, if there was further trouble, they would lose this money and be impoverished. And probably then for that reason, they decided we better get Paul out of here. As soon as it was night, the brothers sent Paul and Silas away to Berea. Once they arrived there, they go to the Jewish synagogue, of course. Now, the Bereans, we read, were of more noble character than the Thessalonians, for they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. So they've got their copies of the scrolls there, and they're coming in and studying these passages that he's referring to and saying, man, is that really the case? And it looks like the reason he says they're of more noble character is because they did study it. They didn't jump with some prejudicial conclusion that, you know, let's kill these guys or whatever, just because they're saying something that's different. And their concern was to examine the scriptures to see if what he said was true. There is the real question. It's not, does this fit in our tradition? Or is this the way we've always done it? Or do we feel like if we go with what Paul says, you know, it might feel good, or it might be fun to go this way? The question is it true? Truth, in this case, meaning a correspondence concept of truth. In other words, that what he's saying correctly corresponds with what the scriptures teach and what God intended. The real question with Jesus is he indeed the Messiah sent from God, or was he just some crackpot who thought he was something that he wasn't? And that's a pretty important question. Well, this is going to come up later in our talk tonight. Truth. And that's what the Bereans were concerned. What's true here? What's the real truth? Many of the Jews believed, we read, as did also a number of prominent Greek women and many Greek men. And of course, there were Greeks in the synagogue because the non-Jewish God-fearers would come and sit in the synagogue and listen to the Bible being taught. They didn't want to become Jewish because they weren't committed enough to that, but they did realize that the monotheism taught in the Bible was true and that their own native polytheism was a bunch of bull. Well, when the Jews, though, in Thessalonica heard that Paul was preaching the word of God at Berea, they went there too, agitating the crowds and stirring them up. And the brothers immediately sent Paul down to the coast, but Silas and Timothy stayed at Berea. I guess they had kept a low enough profile that they could get away with being there. They know who they were. But they're like, Paul's the hot potato. We got to get him out of here. So they send him down with some guys to the coast and apparently sail from there. And they escorted him and brought him to Athens. And then left with instructions for Silas and Timothy to join him as soon as possible. So they go back home and they're going to... Now he's left in Athens all by himself. Not a good place to be if you know anything about Christian ministry. Jesus sent them out two by two. We always minister together. We don't like to be all alone like this. Imagine being in this ancient city, a great city of Athens. Well, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. Yeah, Athens, of course, a great cultural center, famous already for centuries. It was an intellectual center. We think of you know, Plato, Aristotle, you know, all of the great thinkers of Greek philosophy, not just the Greeks themselves revered Athens, but even the Romans did. The Romans viewed Athens as the intellectual center of the world as well. Very pluralistic, meaning you didn't just have one worldview in a city like Athens. You had multiple views, multiple religions all over the place. The Roman writer Xenophon referred to Athens as one great altar, one great sacrifice. Just swarms of shrines and temples all over the place. He says there were more gods in Athens than in all the rest of the country. And John Stott says that Xenophon hardly exaggerates when he says that it was easier to find a god in Athens than to find a man. You know, we go to Athens today and the Parthenon's there, the Acropolis, you know, and there's still spectacular temples there, but it was, most of this stuff has been swept away. There's very little left today, but this place was just, you know, axle to axle deities, idols, and temples and shrines right across the whole city. And so we see that Paul was distressed. And this then becomes the question, okay, so he's getting more agitated, upset, and burdened as he sees all of this idol worship going on. Now, why should that distress him? Well, this brings up for us kind of the theme we want to center on in thinking tonight about this notion of pluralism, where you're confronted with other religious views, other spiritualities, other worldviews, and how is the person to react in the face of that? You know, Western European culture and American culture over recent centuries has been monocultural. That's been Judeo-Christian. And today, American culture is becoming much more pluralistic. We've got huge numbers of other religious views and so forth coming in. And naturalism and various types of mysticism. So it's no longer, you know, when you say the word God today on campus, that might be one of the most contentless words you could use. What is that supposed to mean? It's going to mean something different. Who's God? What God? And it's going to mean something different to different people. And so we're living today as Christians in a pluralistic culture, and what should be our posture relative to that? In this term, pluralism used to refer to a type of tolerance which meant that people have the right to believe what they want and to practice their own religion. And that's kind of built into even the Constitution of the United States, religious freedom. And so that's been a culture, that's been an awesome, frankly, an awesome feature of living in our part of the world here, is that you get to have your own views and people aren't going to hang you or burn you at the stake for it like they did in Europe and like they would still do today in many parts of the world. Many parts of the world, most of the world, really, if you don't conform to the local story they've got, then you're going to be persecuted and maybe killed. So pluralism in that sense has been very good, especially for us, I think, as Bible-believing Christians. We can't be persecuted by the established church anymore. They would probably love to burn us if they could. It's not happening. But today, there's a new version of pluralism or of tolerance that means not only that we have to give people the freedom to believe and to follow their own view, but also that it's an obligation for that we must all affirm that every other worldview is equally valid to our own worldview, that they're all equally valid. Now that's a little bit of a problematic proposition right there. A little problem right there. They're all equally valid, huh? Yeah, you know, this is believed by the preponderant majority of people in our culture today to a radical extreme, which our guy Chris went down and made a video on campus that's kind of funny, kind of demonstrating that people feel so obligated to take this position that they'll follow it even to the most ridiculous extreme.
Do you think there's any one religion that's better than any others?
Not really. I think everyone has their own beliefs.
No?
I don't believe so.
I don't think so. I think it's whatever you believe in, and what you believe in is the important thing, so.
No. No.
Do you think any one religion is better than any other?
No.
But you think it would be wrong if I were to sacrifice animals in my worship?
No. Not wrong. If the human mind conceives it, then it can't be wrong.
I think everybody should find their own way to God.
It's up to the person how they wish to worship.
Some cultures take peyote or drugs or things like that. Some worship idols. Some sacrifice animals. Do you think those are all appropriate or valid ways to worship God?
They're all different. It doesn't mean one's wrong and one's right.
I don't advocate sacrificing animals for the sake of God, but definitely if you have a belief, you've got to follow that. But definitely sacrificing animals is not the way to do it.
As long as there's limitations within there that it doesn't get out of hand. Like a human sacrifice would be a bit much.
Well, I mean, everyone has their own rights, so that's pretty much what I think.
But are they all valid, is my question.
To whoever believes in them, yeah.
This is my God. Okay. This is the idol that I worship. Are you familiar with this idol?
Yes.
This is, do you know who this is?
I know it's one of the Teletubbies, that's all I know.
This is Poe.
Okay, Poe.
Would you like to worship Poe?
No, I wouldn't want to worship Poe. But you can worship Poe all you want.
That's great. I like Poe because Poe does good things for my life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, do you think that this would be a valid way to worship God?
It's, as I said, it's up to you. It's, if you think that that is something that you believe in, then I'm not going to stand in your way, and if other people want to follow you, then that's great.
Would it be as good as your approach to God?
I don't know. I would have to experience it to find out.
Let's say I wanted to worship this guy right here.
Uh-huh.
Would that be equally valid to your approach to God? Like, this is my God right here.
Yeah, okay. So what do you want me to do, confirm or deny it?
Well, yeah, is that as good as your approach to God?
Yeah, I'd say yeah.
There's a group of you that, you know, could get your kicks by worshiping Poe, and that's sort of where you go, and build solidarity, great.
If I wanted to worship Poe.
Teletubby?
Not just any Teletubby. This is Poe. Poe is special, and he gives meaning to my life. Well, you think that this worship of Poe would be just as valid as maybe your way to approach God?
Probably. I'm kind of one of those people who's like, whatever you want to do, just do it. I guess. I mean, if that's what you believe in. I don't think it's, like, necessarily wrong.
Yeah, sure. If that's what you feel like worshiping, knock yourself out. Hey, why not?
Well, definitely. It's not wrong, actually. I mean, if you think that's the way to do it, I mean...
If he's changed your life in a good way, that's great.
If you think that my approach to God, worshiping this toy, is just as valid as your approach, what's that say about your approach?
It just says that it's different. It's not wrong and it's not right. It's just different. I guess you could believe that God takes shape in Poe.
My approach to God is simply God or God and me. So as far as what your approach to your God is, hey, whatever you want to do, man.
What does that say about the way you approach God if you think that my worshiping a toy would be equally valid to the way you worship God?
It just, I mean, that's what I told you, just the way, just see things. I mean, sometimes people just don't accept a particular form of God, but sometimes people just have some of idol worship.
If it's your path, then I'm not going to knock it.
Okay.
I'm not going to try and change it.
So my worship of this toy is equally valid to your approach.
For you.
It's interesting. So, and I'm sure he probably picked the Teletubby thing because it was probably the most ridiculous thing he could think of. But you know, one of the things you notice is that when everything is cool, everything's just as good as anything else, how it really trivializes everything. You know, it's like, if everything's just as good as anything else, then nothing's really worth anything at that point. Let's go back in time to Paul's day here. He's distressed because the city's full of idols, and he's critical. He's not like the people in that video we just saw. Paul seems like he's a little different. He thinks there's something bad that he's seeing here in Athens. Let's take an example, like a classic case, the cult of Dionysus in Greek mythology. Dionysus was the god of wine. He was the liquid fire in the grape. This, you know, ancient people didn't really know why grapes fermented and formed alcohol. So to them, that was a mysterious supernatural process. And they attributed it to a god, to Dionysus. He's called in their literature the blood pounding in the veins of a young animal. All the mysterious and uncontrollable tides which ebb and flow in the life of nature. So it's fertility, it's fermentation, and all of these mysterious kind of natural things that people really didn't understand in that day, and they attributed to Dionysus. The worship of this cult involved wild, drunken sex orgies, where people would go outside of the city into the woods and run around naked. It's pretty, you can imagine why some people like this cult. Ritual prostitution was commonly practiced. Ritual prostitution, where young girls, usually just barely pubescent, 13-year-old girls, were devoted as sex slaves to this cult and would spend their lives being ravished by strange men. Under a theory of sympathetic magic, where coming into the presence of the idol and having sexual coitus there makes the god think, yeah, sex. And then that would cause the god to mate, resulting in fertility, and it would cause him to do his thing. Same Dionysus later was Bacchus, the Roman god of wine, took this same mythology with him. Okay, so this is one of the typical cults. This is one of the many cults there that Paul was looking at in the city of Athens. And he was distressed by that. As I believe we can form a pretty powerful critique of the Dionysian cult ourselves today. In the first place, there's no such thing as Dionysus, okay? We're not dealing with something that's actually true here. Dionysius is no more a real god than that Teletubby was. the worship of Dionysus was immoral and evil. How would you like to find out that you're one of the chosen ones? You're a 13-year-old girl and you've been chosen to be one of these ritual prostitutes. You're taken up there. Every time these girls would get pregnant, they would be summarily aborted using primitive ancient means. Their life expectancy was very short. Oh, this is a cruel, evil cult. There's nothing that's cool, just as cool about this. Dionysius cannot save. If we can believe anything we read in the Bible declares that we've got a pretty serious problem here as human beings. We're separated from our own Creator. And God is upset, especially when we are going to carve some piece of stone and pretend like that is God and bow down to that instead of surrendering to Him, to the true God. If you read your Bible, you find out that God doesn't take that too well. And that idol worship is considered pretty serious as far as God's concerned. It's an insult to Him to think that a stone that you carved with your own two hands would be God. And everybody, according to the Bible, knows better than that. We all know better than that. But we would rather have it that way. Dionysius can't even promote fertility or cause wine to ferment. We know that those things happen for completely different reasons. It has nothing to do with this ancient God whatsoever. In a word, there is nothing good about this cult. And we should have been, if we were there, I would hope that we would be agitated and distressed by what we see, as indeed Paul was. The big word that belongs over this entire cult is false. Not true at all. And so just as we saw earlier, the question of truth stand out is pretty important. It's still important here. Ask yourself this question. Why should a person believe anything? Why believe something? We saw answers in that clip, which was, you know, if it's helping you out, if that's what you feel you need, believe it. Let me suggest a different answer to the question. How about a good reason to believe something is because it's true? What about that? That's why I would like to believe something. Is that you believe things when they're true, and you don't believe them when they're false. I know this is not like our way of thinking today, but there's something there to ponder. The new pluralism, the new version of tolerance that is being advanced, what we saw embodied in the earlier clip, I think has significant problems. I think it's, for one thing, it's an intellectual fad. And what I mean, you know, these fads come through, intellectual fads. When I was a student, it was different stuff than what you see today. But it was the same in the sense that it was a fad. Namely, all the little catchphrases, the language that you hear from different people is so identical, you start to realize they're all thinking together. It's groupthink. You know, it's like they didn't, and when you give even the slightest pushback, or any kind of question posed, well, what about this? Then you get this, what? And it's clear they haven't thought about it at all. They didn't come to this conclusion themselves, but rather have just simply bought into it like you do clothing styles or musical fashion, you know, that it's a desire to be like everyone else. And that, I think, is highly suspect. Especially when you've lived long enough to see about three of these waves come through culture and realize each of them contradict everything that the one before taught, like I am. And it really makes you start to realize a lot of people are being taken in, acting kind of foolish. They're going to look back proudly at this and think, you know, I was really acting like a fool back then. I think it's bothersome to just have someone else telling me what I have to think. And I don't know why this doesn't bother people more. I've never seen such uniform agreement on something this central in my whole life. Of course, it ignores the whole question of truth. It's not whether the Teletubby is God, it's just whether you want him to be God, then believe. And also, a serious complaint I have about this position is that it's hypocritical, invariably hypocritical. Okay, in a couple of ways. First of all, it's hypocritical because you're supposed to respect everybody's religious views, everybody's beliefs, right? And yet that's not what happens. It turns out that certain religions are excluded and they're not to be respected, as you see in this clip. And by the way, let's try not to laugh at what people say, because what we're talking about here is pretty serious.
The question I'm asking people is, should all religions be respected as being valid?
Absolutely. People are entitled to their own opinion. And
yes, everybody has their own beliefs, you know?
I mean, I think as a respectful, moral person, you should respect people and their beliefs.
Well, I think everyone's entitled to feel the way that they want to feel, and I think everyone should, I mean, we should definitely respect everyone for how they feel.
I think everyone's religion should be respected as valid.
Some religions may seem valid to other people, you know, but I think always, no matter what, you should always respect the other religion.
I think they should, because that's one of the things that America was founded on, is religious freedom.
I think definitely they should be. I like to kind of think of religion as sort of a wheel. It's a big wheel, and at the center is God, and then all the different spokes going to the center are all the different religions, and I think while they're all very different, I think they all do have some truth to them, and they should all be considered valid.
So I would say that, yeah, all religions should be considered valid.
The fellows who, blew up the World Trade Center recently, if their religion does teach that, is that a valid expression of their religion? Should it be respected?
No, I don't think so. It's really controversial. You got me. You know, I really don't know where I stand on that, you know? I really don't think so.
I have no idea. I don't know what to do. I mean, if it's sincerely part of their religion, then how justified is that religion in killing people, you know?
You know, it's just like any action. You don't have to respect the action, but you have to respect what's behind the action, though. So, like, I'm totally against what they did, but, yeah, you have to respect the fact that it was their religion.
I guess it goes back to what you believe, and if that religion, I guess, if you believe it wholeheartedly. But I don't know, that's something that I can never do.
I don't respect it. And I know maybe that probably just totally contradicts what I just said, but
if they want to do that within their own culture, that would be okay, but once they bring it into another culture and start murdering people that don't practice that, I don't think that should be valid.
So I hear you saying two things. I hear you saying that you don't agree with what they did, you think it was wrong, and yet you don't have any standard by which to judge them.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You caught me. Well, I don't know. I guess it's, if I was them in the way, I guess if I was raised the way they were, I probably wouldn't think it's wrong, but being the way I was raised in America and my beliefs, I don't necessarily think it's right, but if I was to put in their shoes, I might have done the same thing. I mean, I don't know what they've been through, what their life's like. I'm not in their shoes over there or whatever, so I don't know. That's really tough.
Yeah, the question, you know, I guess is, on what basis do you make that determination that they're not acting properly?
I don't know. It's hard.
And they believed that what they were doing was for God and that they would go to heaven for doing that. Is that valid? Do you want to feel that one first?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. So they weren't too reluctant to say they're wrong, were they? That's wrong. Well, it's offensive. No, they're mistaken. I just haven't thought it through. We're all mistaken. More willing to say that you're wrong on a point like that than to say that Poe is not God. Now we open up our Bible in Isaiah chapter 45, verse 22, and God says, "Turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God, and there is no other." Jesus backed that up. He said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one gets to the Father but through me." So, wow. All of the denials, all of the, no, that's wrong, that can't be right, that we saw in that clip, refer to what we're taught in the Word of God. And people are very willing to not accept the religious or spiritual view of certain people if we dare to violate this doctrine, this dogma that has so seized the postmodern world. And so it can get pretty extreme. Okay, it can get pretty extreme. This is what I mean when I say that it leads to unavoidable hypocrisy. Because you're going to loudly proclaim that all religious views are equally valid. And then you're going to turn right around and say, "Those guys are wrong. That's wrong. That's offensive." And then you're going to turn right around and say, "Oh, but I guess, you know," and be unable to make basic moral judgments. Oh, man, it's got all the marks of an intellectual fad that people have just bitten into and never even stopped to think about much. What about people who believe something that's false? What about that? You know, according to God, those people have a pretty serious problem. When you're believing in something that's false, like Dionysius, and I'm going to stick with my illustration here, you got a serious problem, friend, because you're putting your confidence in something that is never going to help. And meanwhile, the real problem that needs to be dealt with, the separation between you and God, remains unchanged. And you have done nothing about that. One person in the interview said, "Well, I don't think there would be so many religions if there wasn't truth in them." I think the opposite is true. I think that many religions all suggest that none of them are true. That wheel with the spokes coming to the center, what is at the center of that wheel, according to God, the God of the Bible? At the center of the wheel is hell, the judgment of God. And all the religions are heading into that. Idol worship, the thing that was distressing Paul, is leading people into the judgment of God. And that's a serious problem. Now, we may not like it. I don't like it. I'd be just as happy if it was just like, well, you know, just whatever we are is fine. And wouldn't we rather have it that way? But if we can believe one word that God says, we have a serious problem with God, and it needs to be dealt with, and it's not going to be dealt with by believing falsehood. That's why Paul was distressed as he studied the idols. Well, again, he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day with those who happened to be there. It was out there that a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" And so, others remarked, he seemed to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to the meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting?" Areopagus is a meeting of the top intellectuals in the city, and they're going to sit down and evaluate Paul's message. They said, "You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." And Luke kind of gives an aside that all the Athenians and the foreigners who live there spend their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Very authentic type of comment to make about Athens. That's what people were really into, jousting sword play with each other intellectually. And so Paul stands up in the meeting of the Areopagus, and he's going to give a speech to these guys. Wow, the pressure's on now. According to John Stott, this may have had the effect of a trial, because they also had the power to drive out unwanted religion from the city. Anyway, he stands up, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you're very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now, what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you." So already we notice a couple of interesting things about Paul's approach here. He says, "I've been walking around looking carefully at your objects of worship." Oh yeah, Paul didn't just think, "Idol worship, and hide out in his hotel room or whatever." Paul goes wading right into these temples, and he's looking at the inscriptions and studying, watching their practices. Right into me, he studied carefully, he says, looked carefully at your objects of worship. And so unlike a fundamentalist mentality today where we need to get out of culture and escape culture, he carefully studied their culture. He's going to be able to point out and find common ground between himself and them because he's immersed in Greek culture here. He even found this one called a shrine to an unknown God. By the way, the existence of this shrine was confirmed by extra-biblical historical sources. Two of them talk about that this shrine was there. And so here Paul is studying idol worship and watching people worship idols. And he comes in and sees this one. He's like, "That's it. There's my common ground right there. They don't even know who he is. I do. I'm going to tell them. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built with hands." And so the first thing he calls their attention to is the creator of all things, something which, according to Paul in another passage, they already had sensed. They already knew that there must be an almighty God who had created all things, or else you just have an inadequate explanation. A God who creates the world in which we live has to be adequate to account for that. And the Greek and Roman gods were just sort of like demigods. They were semi-gods who were like overgrown human beings, but not vast and transcendent enough to account for this entire creation that we have here. And he says, such a God does not live in temples built by hands. Yeah, that's called the transcendence of God. Oh, so you're going to build a little doghouse and keep God in there. That's nice. Yeah, that's what you do with your dog. You don't build a house for God. Like, he needs you to build a house for him. That's great. And yet, you know, it's amazing that he's busting out like this, because this is exactly what they believed. He's sitting just feet away from the magnificent statue of Athena there in the Acropolis, and all these temples around there, and that's exactly what they believe. And he's just like, boom, wrong. He says, he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. And so he hits them with the self-existence of God. This is a trait of God where God exists by virtue of himself. He has no needs, needs nothing from us. Not like their gods. They actually believed when they offered animal sacrifice in Greek religion, they believed that they were feeding the gods. That the gods would be offended because they would be hungry if they didn't get their meal. A very primitive, simple belief. That has nothing to do with the transcendent, self-existent God who lives and needs nothing from anyone. And that's, of course, why he is a giver. And he's not worried about what he can get. He himself gives all men life, breath, and everything else. It's we who receive from him. And this refers to the sovereignty of God. everything we are, everything we have, all ultimately came from God. He created the universe and He owns it. It's His. It's His universe. Psalms 24:1, the earth is the Lord's and everything and everyone in it belongs to Him. And so He has a say. He is the sovereign of the universe. Now that's, oh boy, we don't want to hear that. We'd rather make the decision. I don't want somebody telling me what to do. Yeah, well, God is sovereign, okay? And He's there, really, not just in our imagination. From one man, He made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and He determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. And so he's declaring that God created diversity in the world. That the way that humans have diversified has been superintended and that God approved of that. It's an interesting counter to the usual view, which is that only our people are the only real humans and the others are all subhuman. And he rejects that and says, actually, this diversity of humans is God's will. He says God did this so that men would seek Him and perhaps reach out for Him and find Him. No, He is never far from each of us. This is something that's called general revelation that throughout the ages, and of course we're reading a quick summary of this lecture that he gave. It's probably explained these points a lot better, but this is probably talking about how people can look out into nature and realize that God must be there. You can look into your own self and sense, I'm a very sophisticated personal being. With self-awareness and morality and all these things, creativity, this seems like I must come from a pretty high source, a personal God. And then when people realize this, they can seek. Jesus said, seek and you shall find. Knock and the door will be open. Ask and you'll receive. People can reach out for God and He sees that. It says His eyes roam to and fro over the earth looking for people like that, and He will answer them when they do. Of course, this is a complete rejection of the notion of unconditional election. He says people can seek Him and find Him. And He says, though He is never far from each one of us. And so, over against the transcendence and the awesomeness of God, He puts something else called the immanence of God, which means the closeness of God, that He's right here, that we can know Him, that He can be related to. He's not just the unspeakable other, that being which, if we try to describe Him in any way, just limits Him, so we just like don't even say anything about Him. That's all transcendence. No, there's also the immanent aspect. The God of the Bible, He's transcendent, all right, but He is also immanent. He's a lover of people. He wants relationship with people. You can actually have Him come into your life. He's never far. Yeah. For in Him we live and move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said, we are His offspring. Both of these statements are not Paul's. These are not original statements. He's quoting two Greek poets, Epimenides and Aratus. That's an interesting point right there, isn't it? And so as he's lecturing to them, he's quoting their own guys to them by heart. He doesn't even have to say, let me go look that up. Let's see, what did he say? He's got this, he's familiar with their literature, with their, this was their entertainment. This would be like quoting from The Matrix or some movie or something, you know. And again, it shows that Paul would find cultural common ground, you know, with the people he's ministering to. Therefore, he says, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. Here's this idea that you're going to carve a stone thing and then you're going to be like, oh God, you know, I worship you. You are my God. You just made that, dude. That's really stupid, okay? And so he rejects all the reduced formalistic versions of God, even though his audience are sitting there and this is exactly what they do and practice. Well, I'm sure some of them didn't. Some of them probably realized, as we read from the historians at the time, that a number of Greeks thought the whole pantheon thing was stupid. They didn't really believe in it. But most people went along with it for, you know, public approval. And he says, in the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, to change their heart. He's really losing it here, isn't he? He's not too politically correct right here. I can't believe he's referring to their sincerely held religious beliefs as ignorance. It'll take some guts to give this speech in front of that crowd, I can tell you that. He's really coming, he's barreling right down at them. Got to admire that. It is ignorant. That coverage where we were talking about Dionysius, you don't think that's ignorant? We know better than that. None of that's true. It's ignorance. And so he's calling them to turn away from the false and turn toward the true God, the living God. And that's what he's talking about. See, yes, he's speaking in enthesis and antithesis. But here's the tragic thing about our world today. Nothing is really false, right? So, you know, not even the Teletubby. Nothing you can, it's like whatever you want. Oh, they're all equally valid, so nothing's false. Tragically, that means nothing's really true either. It just completely trivializes the whole area. And makes the whole thing meaningless. There's nothing to talk about. It's just, oh yeah, whatever. And we've just cut ourselves off from meaningful discourse about anything spiritual. And so we've got this very sad situation today of people wandering around with an aching spiritual hole in the middle of their heart, but unable to do anything about it because they feel obligated to march in lockstep with the culture's expectation that nothing is better than anything else. And it's all, see, we can say, oh, all spirituality is beautiful. Or we can say, all of it is crap. And those are exactly the same statements either way. At least if we admit the reality of falsehood, that gives the possibility of truth. Yeah, what about that? Maybe there really is something to believe in that's not just wishful thinking, that isn't just me deciding I want to believe in a Teletubby, but is actually the true living God. That would be pretty exciting. Maybe we could even know him in a personal way because he's imminent. That would be pretty exciting. Well, he goes on and says he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he's appointed. And he's given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. Oh boy, now the judgment of God. And of course our dependency on God and his nature as good, as righteous, and as just requires that he not look the other way at all the atrocity going on here on earth. If God is not a God of justice, then we've got serious problems in our theology. I can tell you that right now. We've got a God that treats evil and goodness the same. And what does that tell you? It tells you you've got a real questionable being on your hand. Thank God he's not that way. And that he is a God of justice. But he's also a great God of mercy because he's given us a way to get out of his justice through Jesus Christ. And he demonstrated this to all men by raising him from the dead. I think demonstrated again. Yeah, I suppose it would be proof if you happened to be there like Paul was. Paul knew that Jesus had risen from the dead because he had confronted him. So he knew it was true. And the resurrection of Jesus, the linchpin of Christian teaching. If Jesus had just died and that was the end of the story, we would have nothing here. We wouldn't even be sitting here. It's only if he raised back up. Paul says, if this didn't happen, you can forget anything I ever told you. I'm nothing but a liar if this didn't happen. Well, when they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, we want to hear you again on this subject. the sneering, because in Greek, a lot of Greek thought is dualistic, it's Platonic. They disparage the physical absolutely. And so to have a resurrection of the body would be repugnant to many Greeks. Others, though, were responsive, and we read that as Paul left the council, a few men followed him and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus. That's, he's named after Dionysius, okay? It's not actually him. Also a woman named Damaris and a number of others. So, you know, sounds pretty good to me. I'd be happy to get out of there not only alive, but also with some people who have believed. There are some that try to say, well, this speech didn't work out for Paul, so he changed his methods. Not true. There's no indication of that in the text. Okay, so there's the story, and let's try to draw a couple of conclusions before we wrap up. First of all, we don't decide what God is like, okay? Do we really suppose that God is a being who's there like, okay, now what shall I be for you? What shall I be for you? Not true. God is God, right? It's not up to us. We don't even have a vote. And so we're confronted with truth here. Truth which we have to adjust our view to what is true. Not that we decide, well, I'll just make this true for me. You can do that if you want. It ain't going to change anything. God is God, the real God who is there. Pluralism, respect for others, yeah, good, that's good. I'm all for that. But when we say that we should treat people respectfully, we don't mean that we're respecting their false views, but that we're respecting the person. We're acting respectfully toward the person. That's what we should be saying. Not that all views are equally valid, which is a foolish proposition. In fact, today's pluralism is absurd, it's shallow, it's hypocritical, and I'm sorry. There you have it. And if I think anybody that spends a little bit of time, you know, there's actually some shift away from this. I noticed, especially at Ohio State, several faculties here are becoming pretty highly critical of this kind of universal relativistic point of view. We have to come to grips with the God who's actually there, not the one of our imagination. And I'm not done. I got a couple other points. Are you going to let other people tell you how you have to think? I would hate that. I do hate that. That's one of the things that always bothered me about fads like this, is that if you break ranks, if you say something different than what everyone else is saying, then you're going to stick out like a sore thumb. Everybody's going to be like, oh, what's wrong with you? And you're going to get judged. But on the other hand, how long are you going to live your life letting other people dictate what you have to think? Maybe you should try thinking for yourself for a change. Got that. What does God ask? What does he want? Let's listen to his own words right out of the Bible. John 1 verse 12. Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. That's all. And so God wants us to take our false beliefs and set those aside and instead believe what is true, which is that he's come here to rescue us in the person of Jesus. If we receive Jesus, if you invite Jesus into your life, you can be forgiven. Everything you've done, swept away. And it's all put onto the cross and was judged there on Jesus in your place. And then you can have a relationship with God. He will come and he will show himself to you. Even if you have doubts, even if you're not sure, tell him that you're open and that you want him to come and manifest himself to you, because he's a personal being and he's imminent. He will come and let you know he's there. And that is really the message that Paul was trying to preach. Well, next time we'll follow Paul into the raunchy city of Corinth, which far worse than Athens, as a matter of fact, at this time.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.